I planned to call this message Fake Wasabi, because though most sushi places do serve a green pasty goo with every roll they roll, what they plunk on your plate isn't real wasabi. Did you know that? It's a fake look-alike made out of horseradish, mustard, and green food coloring. Yum. Point being, you have never, likely, even tasted real wasabi. But even though the real stuff is smoother and better tasting than the slime we've gobbled down, since the fake stuff is what we know, it's also what we like. Because to our uninformed taste buds, that green-looking mortar, it's real, even though it's not. See, it's so easy to be fooled. Fooled into believing that what seems real really is real. Or to believe that whatever we're told does in fact matter. For example, we tend to believe, because that's what they tell us, that titles and power and money is what makes life grand. So we covet these things, wishing for stuff that another has, but we don't. We set our sights and begin a rabid pursuit after degrees, trophies, plaques, building up piles of money, sweating and straining for an idyllically fit body. And there's nothing intrinsically wrong with any of that. But is it real? Meaning, are such things truly the essential ingredients of a life well lived, or do they actually possess no eternal value at all? Got a quiz to help you take where I want to go. Can you name five of the eight wealthiest people on the planet, even with this picture to guide you? How about last year's Academy Award winners for Best Actor, male and female? How about the last four Super Bowl champs? My guess is nobody could fully answer any of those questions. Anybody? Get it 100%. Okay. Who scored an incomplete on all three? Me too. Even though those are the ones we consider to be the best of the best of them all. These are the few who have reached the pinnacle, that shining city, that pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. We've reached that unreachable star, yet we don't even remember who they are. None of us. Even though they've gotten to where we desperately wish we could be. See, the real truth is success promises big but delivers little. Maybe fake is a little harsh, but success just never keeps her promise. And though we latch on to a pursuit of success, all right, we're changing the message today. Though we latch onto a pursuit of success like a fighter pilot locks onto an enemy target, once we make the kill, if in fact we do, the thrill is not at all what we thought it would be. But just like every generation has to discover for itself, if you touch a hot stove, you're going to get burned, each generation also has to learn that success never brings even close to what we thought it would. And that's why we pursue success with such abandon. And in the process, forget what truly matters. Missing birthdays, graduations, weekly worship, all because we're convinced all my efforts one day will pay off. That's when I'm going to cash in on that horse called happiness, because I will finally have arrived. But I got a second part to this quiz. It's easier. Can you name two teachers who made you want to be better? Or an unknown personal hero whose story inspired you? How about somebody that helped you through a rough patch? Did a face instantly flash? And one person that you would trust with your most intimate confession? If you're like me, you probably scored way better on this part of the quiz. And it's because the people who really matter aren't necessarily those with fistfuls of money and truckloads of answers. I thought about that while I was in San Diego with my family last weekend. I watched with joy as my grandkids played together building sandcastles, and they were so intent on their project, meticulous with every crumbling corner and toppling tower, the passion with which they struggled to build their world's greatest castle was priceless. But then, as it is wont to do, a wave would build. But kids don't panic, do they? Instead, kids do the strangest thing. They jump to their feet, they scream with delight as a surge of salt water washes their dream castle all away. No panic, no sadness, no bitterness, because kids instinctively realize the inevitability of building castles. You and I should be so wise. God didn't create you to be famous, to get rich, to live in the biggest house or drive the fanciest car. Yet we get so caught up in these things. We climb our chosen ladder only to discover it was leaning against the wrong wall. But God didn't create you for your own glory, but for His. And He put you here to do this, to love people and to do holy things. Your destiny is not purposed in physical measurements, but spiritual. Meaning, living to be 100 is way less significant than living well, even if for just a short time. As I watched our kids with their castles and imagined them being swept away, I thought of something Jesus told His disciples at a time when their perceived success was at its peak. Listen to this. The 72 had returned from their assignment with joy. They said, "Lord, even the demons submit to us in Your name." Jesus replied, "I've given you authority to trample on snakes and scorpions and to overcome the power of the enemy. Nothing's going to harm you. However, do not rejoice that the spirits submit to you. Rejoice that your names are written in heaven." Did you catch that? His disciples raced back with exciting news of power and impact, and yet He said, "Do not rejoice." In other words, if God gives you success for a season, if He puts the wind at your back, by all means, enjoy it. Just don't hang your hat on it, because it ain't real. It's earthly success. And though it is a gift from God, it is also fleeting. I love that Jesus said that. Because see, even in ministry, we can be tempted to build our platforms and chase fame and build our high, shiny castles of sand and maybe get a little Christian celebrity to boot. Yet, do not rejoice. Or as the prophet Jeremiah said to his assistant, "Do you seek great things for yourself? Seek them not." That's worth remembering. You understand, you and I must always be shy about ourselves, but ever boastful about Jesus. Our ambition is to advance His kingdom, never with an eye on our own. And I think somebody needs to say this, too. This idea of measuring a church's success numerically or in terms of facility or branding or books our pastor has written, that idea came from us, not Jesus. So do not rejoice. Even though our church's mission is to lead people to follow Jesus, which is just another way of saying our big goal as His disciples is to make more disciples. Here's the problem. Nobody can agree on what a real disciple looks like. Are you with me? Because measuring righteous, it's like eating fake wasabi. How can you know it's fake unless you know what is real? Besides, I've compiled a comprehensive list of all the good things that will happen to you when you compare your success to somebody else's. You ready? See, the key to living a life that is real is make much of Jesus. Because exalting His name is a far superior thing to making a name for you. Because apart from Jesus, all of us, even the most successful among us, we are going to one day wither like a vapor. You will. I will. I love how Anne Lamott put it. She said, 100 years from now, all new people. So if the wind is at your back, enjoy it. Just don't rejoice because of it. And if the wind is in your face, you can still rejoice. Because as Jesus said, your name is written in God's book. And what could be better than that? I think a lot about these things. Because the last thing I want to do as your pastor is serve fake wasabi. Or to leave even the slightest impression that I know what successful Christian living looks like. Because I don't. Neither, for the record, did Peter. However, without suggesting that his list was a comprehensive list for what righteous looks like, Peter, I think with fear and trembling, gives us his partial list for how to measure whether you're successfully following in the footsteps of Jesus. And I'd like to give it to you. You good with that? Cool. Here's the first one. Finally, all of you live in harmony with one another. Wow. Item number one on Peter's short list of what righteous looks like is, as a successful believer, you will possess a harmonious disposition. Even in a world marked by drawing bold lines of diversity, the righteous always seek unity. Now understand, he's not calling for unison. He's after harmony. Not that we all sing precisely the identical notes, but that as we sing, maybe a third or a fifth or a second, maybe an occasional seventh, because we are all grounded in the same root chord, Jesus, the very diversity of the differing notes we sing actually adds beauty to our song in groups this year. And by the way, did I mention there's sign up in the lobby? One of our course selections is about following Jesus yet refusing to pick sides. And we're tackling some tough topics. So, if you're tired of feeling the need to pick winners or losers, or decide based on what hits your news feed who's right and who's wrong today, so that you're endlessly calling balls and strikes, or whether what some dunderhead in Washington or Hollywood just said reflects the wisdom of Gandhi or the stupidity of Garfield, if your desire is to simply sing the story of your life in Jesus with a beautiful, moving, loving, soaring anthem of enchanting harmony, not uniformity, not unanimity, just harmony, Peter says, if that's the kind of follower you want to be, what you will also be is righteous. Item two, be sympathetic. If your goal is to successfully follow Jesus, you got to seek to be, as they said of Him, able to sympathize with weakness. Because Jesus had a sensitivity for people on the margins and would daily step into our brokenness and feel with us our feelings. And Peter says that ought to be our goal. Paul said the same. He said, rejoice with those who rejoice and mourn with those who mourn. When we got back to Anthem, I was immediately told about a mild disturbance in second service last Sunday. If you were in second and it distracted or unsettled you, I'm sorry about that. But I'm also thrilled because our safety and security team stepped up and balanced so beautifully our calling to both care for those who are worshiping, but also for those who are troubled. I asked an elder about it, and you know what he said? That's our calling, Steve. And it's going to happen more and more as God gives increase, and there's a sign out there on the expressway. But people, don't forget, we are called to reach people on the margins. Not to frown because they don't conform to our norm, but to love them gently into the kingdom, just as we were once loved when we were outside. But then I read something else. Did you know America's most at-risk group is preteens and teens from affluent, well-heeled families? You and I tend to think that real ministry is what happens down in the hood. That ain't true. Because in spite of enormous economic and social advantages, children of influence are experiencing the highest rate of depression, substance abuse, anxiety disorders, sleeping issues, and downright unhappiness more than any other group of people. With 22% of adolescent girls from financially comfortable families. Do I need to flash welcome to Anthem? 22% suffer from clinical depression. That's three times the rate of girls less fortunate. Does that break your heart for the North Valley as it breaks mine? Enough maybe to step up and help? I first heard these words about 40 years ago, but I still haven't recovered. Martin Niemöller, a German theologian who endured the darkness of Nazi Germany, said, "First they came for the communists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the socialists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me." Is that how you respond to our world's brokenness? If it doesn't affect me, I'll pass. Is that you? When somebody falls into a moral ditch, when a woman's life unravels because of a scandalous sin, do you point the finger and walk away? Or do you crawl down into that ditch and pull her out? Peter said, down in that ditch, that's where righteous is found. He also said, love as brothers. That's the Greek word philadelphios. And it means a friendly, brotherly affection. And here's my favorite definition of friendship. A friend is someone who knows the song in your heart and will sing it back to you when you forget the words. That's a real friend. You got a friend like that? I didn't ask if you once had one. How about right now? How about right here? Is there someone who gives you comfort and strength and nourishes your soul and lifts your downcast spirit? That's one of the reasons we push groups, not to guilt you into yet another time commitment, but because there is great value in life-on-life, authentic Christian relationships. So our goal really is that everyone who calls the Crossroads home, even if it's just part of the year, that you're in a group seeking friends with whom you can be transparent and real. Just remember the words of Dale Carnegie. He said, you can make more friends in 2 months by becoming interested in other people than you can make in 2 years trying to get other people interested in you. And he's right. So if you want to be truly righteous, friend development must rank very high on your list. I agree with Jay Kessler. This is my goal too. He said, one of my great goals in life is to wind up with at least 8 people who will attend my funeral without checking their watches. Do you have 8 who'd do that? Or 6 to carry the handles on the box that carries you? Or 2 who'd drop off a casserole to your family left behind? Jesus said, if we love one another, that's how people are going to know that we really are disciples. But let's keep moving. Peter also said, be compassionate. A word that is my all-time favorite Greek word, splankna. Say that with me, splankna. Matthew first used that word in chapter 9 to describe a very hectic day in the life of Jesus. Except even in the madness, Jesus paused. And having paused, he looked. And having looked, he saw something. Matthew says he saw the crowds, not a blob of faceless people. He saw people who were harassed, beaten down by life, mangled, wiped out. He also saw that they were helpless and perceived this vague, empty craving of a life without hope. He also saw them wandering around like sheep without a shepherd. Successful? Probably. Yet bewildered, dazed, and afraid. And then, having seen something, he felt something. Splunkna. He had compassion. A word that means, get ready, the inner bowels. You see, the Greeks taught that when humans feel emotions, we don't feel it in our hearts, we feel it in our guts. And that's why when we get upset, some people can't eat at all, and others of us can't eat enough. Because we're upset. That's why we get ulcers and acid indigestion and irritable bowel. However, having felt splunkna, Jesus did something. He helped them. He saw their lives in disarray, the overwhelming enormity of their spiritual need, and he taught them, and then he healed them. He was so moved, his stomach churning with splunkna. He couldn't not do something. A man hurt his arm and went to the ER, but when he got there, the place was empty except two doors that read male and female. So he went through the door marked male, only to land in another room with two more doors that said above the waist or below the waist. So he went through the door that said above the waist, only to find another room with two more doors marked internal and external. So he went through the one that was marked external, found two more doors marked major and minor. He thought, well, it's probably minor. So he went through the door and found himself back outside in the parking lot. His wife said, "You get help at the hospital?" He said, "Not really, but they sure were organized." I wonder if maybe people feel that same way around here. We're organized, but not helping. Do people in your life truly sense that you truly feel splunkna for them? Just as with Jesus, compassion is more than just feeling something. It's doing something. And far too often, that's where our compassion breaks down. But not Jesus. He saw people hurting. He felt something. Then he did something. And Peter says, righteous is the saint who follows in his footstep. But he's not done. He says, finally, now that's a preacher trick because he's not done. Finally, all of you, live in harmony, be sympathetic, love as brothers, be compassionate and humble. Ouch. Righteous is the saint who is humble. A tough assignment for everybody, but especially tough if you're successful. Years ago, a famous pastor and mentor of mine was leading a staff meeting, and one of his team members, another friend, remembers this famous pastor telling his staff that Satan had the power to tempt him in a lot of ways, but the one area of his life where not even Satan could touch him was his marriage. Not 1 year later, that same famous pastor was caught in bed with a mistress. True story, and that ought to bring the fear of God into your heart and cause you to humbly be willing to admit your frailties. Because it's not just Bible stories, folks. These same stories happen every day, even among the most well-intended and outwardly successful Christian leaders. Because there's potential in us all, even the most virtuous, to become ensnared by unthinkable transgression. Think of it. If Abraham, the father of faith, could give up his wife twice to be sexually abused just to save his own hide, are we not also capable of saving me at the expense of others? If Jacob, the father of Israel's 12 tribes, could live a lie concerning his birthright, aren't we also capable of living lies? If Rahab, an ancestor of Jesus, could abuse her body as a prostitute, aren't we capable of immorality? If Peter, one of the 12 apostles, the author of this letter we're studying, could fall into xenophobic, racist behavior after Jesus had restored him back into ministry for that very same issue, and if Barnabas, the son of encouragement, could stumble in alongside Peter, aren't we also capable of excluding people that don't look like us? If King David, who gave us beautiful worship music, who identified or was identified by the Lord as a man after his own heart, if he could abuse his power by having sex with Bathsheba, the daughter of one of his best friends, she slept with him, and then David, to cover it up, had her husband killed. If he could do that, aren't we capable of doing even worse? We could add others to the list. John Calvin, who consented to a man's execution for the crime of disagreeing with Calvin's doctrine. Or Martin Luther, who made racist, anti-Semitic remarks. Or Jonathan Edwards, who owned slaves until the day he died. Now, on the one hand, these stories can be encouraging, because if there's hope for them, there's hope for me. On the other hand, their stories, their foolishness ought to teach us that we got to try to live differently, to guard our hearts, because our hearts, especially when we believe that we're not vulnerable, we are actually more vulnerable than we could imagine. So, if you're thinking you're standing firm, be careful that you do not fall. For no temptation has seized you except what is common. Are you someone, maybe even a successful someone, who thinks, I'm not vulnerable? That's kind of like looking at an acorn and thinking such a tiny thing could never become an oak tree or a forest fire. But see, sin in your heart, it's like that acorn, and it possesses the power, if not crushed, to germinate, to sprout, to become a tree, ultimately a forest, then fire. And that's in part why Jesus warned not only against adultery, but against lust in your heart. And why he not only warned against murder, but against carrying a grudge in your heart. Because every adulterous flame begins with that harmless glance. And every murderous rampage begins with itsy bitsy grudge. That's why wherever our hearts are exposed, it's essential that we crush that acorn before it becomes a sprout, that we dig up that sprout before it becomes a tree, that we chop down that tree before it becomes a forest, and we plow that forest into the dirt before it takes even more territory through fire. God told Cain, sin is crouching at your door, but you must master it. Cain, master your sin, lest it end up crushing you and maybe those around you. John Owen put it this way. He said, always be killing sin, or sin will be killing you. Or Pink, the great theologian, who sang, don't let me get me. I'm a hazard to myself. God have mercy on us all. God protect us and save us from ourselves. For no self-serving pursuit can quench the thirsting of the human soul that was made to contain the image of God. Augustine said it, the Lord has made us for himself, and our hearts will be restless. Wrong language there. I'll read from my computer. The Lord has made us for himself. Our hearts will be restless till they find their rest in him. That's hilarious. Next on Peter's list, a forgiving spirit. He says, do not repay evil with evil or insult with insult, but with blessing, because to this you were called, so that you will inherit a blessing. Isn't it interesting that right on the heels of humility, Peter mentions the greatest humiliation of all, my need to forgive. But you want to know why we struggle to forgive? Forgive and forget. Easily the most quoted proverb of forgiveness, which isn't even in the Bible. Someday I'm going to do a whole teaching on this. For now, I just drop it in the pot and let it simmer. All my life, I've heard that forgive and forget drumbeat, because that's what a good Christian would do. Even though I'm not sure how forget is something anybody could ever hope to do. Forget, mind, just forget. How can you will yourself to do that? So, I have come to believe, maybe you'll consider me a heretic, that there are actually three levels of forgiveness. Two absolutely required, the third, God's goal for us all. Level number one is I refuse to retaliate. I will not hurt you for hurting me. Level two, I'm going to reconcile the wrong. Whatever got wrong, I'm going to get it undone. Level number three, I will restore the relationship so that what we had before, we will have again. Now, I believe all three levels involve forgiveness. I really do. The problem is our shame makes us try to leap all the way to level three forgiveness, though we can't imagine how, apart from an active reconciliation of the wrongs done, level number two, we could ever hope to get there. So what happens? We try to forgive, but we choke. But who said we got to get all the way to level three? See, if you've been hurt, and you really want forgiveness, which is God's plan for you, level one may be about as far as you dare go, at least right now. Because what you can do, we all can do this, is choose not to retaliate. That you stop sticking pins in my voodoo doll, right? And instead, you let God readjust your heart so that by God's grace, you actually learn to love me again. This is cheek-turning time. It's walk-another-mile time. That season where you train your brain to think different thoughts. Not getting even, not setting traps so that I keep falling in them, not keeping a record of my wrongs. You release all of that. Level one forgiveness doesn't mean you deny the hurt, because what you did or what I did to you, it hurt you. But you're not going to hurt me, even though I did hurt you. Now, once that forgiveness happens, you climb to level two by seeking to reconcile the wrong. What happened, happened. You can't turn that ship around. But reconciliation means your first thought about that person who hurt you isn't the hurt, but rather, how can I bridge the divide? How can I do something to change the narrative? Remember Jesus on the cross? He's a great illustration of how you may never get a chance to do that, but it was still forgiveness what happened on the cross. Remember how he forgave the thief and promised him a place in paradise? That was reconciliation, level two forgiveness. But Jesus' promise, his offer of forgiveness, was never put to the test because he went to heaven and the thief died. So we never got to see what might have happened had they interacted after that moment. Now, Paul and Barnabas do help us here because they never did find full restoration, level three forgiveness. What we had before, we're going to have again. Not Paul and Barnabas. See, they had a sharp disagreement, the Bible says. And even though they found a place of peace, Paul went one way, Barnabas went the other. They'd been partners before, but now and forever separated. Does that mean these two giants of the faith never did forgive each other? No. They just couldn't work with each other. And that's why I believe that level three forgiveness absolutely... I don't believe that level three forgiveness absolutely has to happen for forgiveness to happen. It's God's best if it did, and full restoration is always the goal. But just because you forgive someone who harmed you doesn't mean they're going to change. Have you noticed that? And become what you hoped they would be. And though you may work toward that end and pray toward that end, it may not happen. I'm still praying for relational resolve in my life. Over 20 years ago, harm was done to me. And though I extended reconciliation many times. The ones who hurt me still haven't acknowledged that anything they did harmed me. Does anybody else have that experience in your life? So you feel kind of ridiculous for constantly sticking your neck out and offering grace after grace after grace, hoping for a positive result that just never will come. Just understand, this helped me a whole lot. You're not offering forgiveness as a performance to be graded. You're forgiving with Jesus as your example. And see, nobody else can do that for you. So whatever level you can do for now, that's forgiveness. I hope that helps somebody, because that comes from years of me plotting, trying to look like Jesus, trying to help others look like Jesus, yet never able to fully do what I thought was being asked of me, forgive and forget. Now I just try to do as Jesus did. I try to cover all shame with the gospel. That's what Peter says every successful believer should aspire to do. Instead of tearing other people down or spreading junk on the internet, I will seek to assume the best in people and work to catch them doing good instead of trying to find the ways they've messed up. The forgiveness of Jesus frees us, hallelujah, to live like that. I wonder, do you? Do you cover others' sin, including mine, simply because that's what grace does? As Peter says, not only were you called to do that, when you do that, do you see it? You'll inherit a blessing. Finally, and I mean it, Peter says a real Christian also possesses a positive outlook. For whoever would love life and see good days must keep his tongue from evil and his lips from deceitful speech. He must turn from evil and do good. He must seek peace and pursue it. Wow, now look at that. Whoever would love life and see good days. That's me. Is that you? You want to love life, see good days? And really, I mean, among all people on the planet, don't you think we believers alone have good reason to laugh? Every once in a while, I'll get a note from somebody that says, Pastor Steve, you sure do laugh a lot in this church. They mean it as a criticism. I take it as a compliment. Because if anybody ought to laugh, it's us, right? Because no matter how bad it gets, and it's kind of bad, the one who is in you is greater than the one who is in the world. And did not Jesus say, I have come that you may have life and have it? And since in Christ we have forgiveness of sin, the promise of eternal life, a meaningful purpose behind every breath we breathe, if anybody ought to have a positive spin on life, it is us. So get over it. Life is tough. Suck it up. And no, I am not trying to clone Joel Osteen. I'm thinking. I get reality. And sometimes reality is bad, with racism and sexual perversion at their highest levels, mass murders like never before, child abandonment, spousal abuse, deadbeat dads, an ugly list, and it never, ever ends. And the tendency is, the uglier it gets, the more twisted our response to it. Not to mention, we get glum, cynical, crabby, and hostile. But is that really the response we believers ought to make? Is it true that every joy in life is extinguished? Is there no more reason for laughter? I agree with Charles Kuralt. He says it does no harm just once in a while to acknowledge the whole country isn't in flames and there are people in this country besides politicians, entertainers, and criminals. So lighten up. Someone said 92.7% of all news is negative, even the weather. Check your phone. What do you see? 20% chance of rain today. How come it doesn't say there's an 80% chance of sunshine? The odds are greater, right? When we're driving, we got to stop for stoplights. How come they don't call them go lights? Isn't that their purpose? You get back-to-back texts from somebody, the same person, under 30 seconds. What do you figure? Somebody died. Because we're conditioned to think negatively. Years ago, back in the Midwest, I was driving to a town where I was scheduled to speak, and posted at the city limits was a sign I'll never forget. We hear there's a recession coming, but we've decided not to participate. Love that. Well, I hear the family unit is tanking, that the church is no longer a voice for our culture, but I'm not going to participate. Better buy gold, because, well, you know, and MREs, because Armageddon. But Peter says, cultivate a positive attitude even in this negative culture. Because if you love life, people will love you and want to be around you and enjoy spending time with you. I read about a woman who's just turned 100, but her mind is quick and her wit is sharp. A reporter asked her, "You got any children?" She said, "Not yet." Now that's my kind of people right there. But when somebody's always moping and moaning and griping and complaining, I can't get away fast enough. Oh, just save it, Wyatt. If you had to deal with what I had to deal with, you'd be crabby too. No. I agree with Viktor Frankl, who spent 3 years in a Nazi death camp. Having survived those atrocities, listen to what he wrote. "We who lived in concentration camps remember the men who walked through the huts comforting others, giving away their last piece of bread. They may have been few, but offer sufficient proof that everything can be taken from a man but one thing. The last of the human freedoms is to choose one's attitude in any set of circumstances." And he's right. No matter what you face, you can either use it to celebrate life or feel sorry for yourself. You can mope and moan, carp and complain, harp and harangue, waxing eloquently as you bemoan your horrible lot in life, if that's how you want to live. But don't blame your circumstances. It's your attitude that's the problem. Okay, Peter, how do I get to this positive outlook? Three things. Whoever would love life and see good days must keep his tongue from evil and his lips from deceitful speech. That's Bible for stick a sock in it. And endure what you endure quietly. And if that's an issue for you, here's a verse that could help you. "Set a guard over my mouth, O Lord. Keep watch over the door of my lips." Is that great or what? God, just clamp it down. Because I want to be a successful, righteous person. I need to shut up. Peter also says, turn from evil and do good. If you want a positive view on life, stop tolerating your secret sin and pursue goodness instead. And then third, he says, seek peace. Not conflict, not argument, not debate. Seek peace and pursue that. All right, we're going to wrap. Maybe as you think through that list of seven and how far you got yet to go, me too, maybe you're wondering if the trip is worth it. I love the story Ruth Graham loved to tell of the time Billy was away on a crusade and she was at home trying to corral four very active kids who had sleep issues. One morning she awakened after having been awakened several times through the night, dragged herself into the kitchen, picked up baby Franklin out of his crib and set him in his high chair without changing his diaper. Then, with no makeup or unbrushed hair, she sat through what was complete breakfast bedlam. Every time her older daughter, Gigi, would try to say something, Bunny, the younger, would butt in. Till finally, Gigi slammed her fork on the table and said, "Mother, between looking at you, smelling Franklin, and listening to Bunny, I've lost my appetite." I get that. maybe you do too. Maybe that's how you feel. Time was you cared a lot about your righteous life in Christ. But lately, not so much. Well, if that's where you are, Peter's got one final word. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are attentive to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. And that's why we got to keep trying. Because God has promised to draw near to us, even if evil is being done to us. He just keeps coming and coming and coming near and watching, not to catch you in an epic fall. He's watching to see you climb, not waiting to pounce in the moment that you blow it, but to pick you up in the moment that you fall. And just in case you think that's just a load and it's not really true, it's not what God's about, remember this verse. The eyes of the Lord range throughout the earth to strengthen those whose hearts are fully committed to Him. Is it? Is your heart fully committed to Jesus? Or have you somehow managed to make everybody else in your life happy, mostly you, but not Him? I ask because the Bible would suggest if you have successfully pleased everybody in your life, but you fail to please God, I don't care what else you may have managed to do with your life, if you have failed to please God, my friend, you have failed. You're just serving up fake wasabi. Because in the end, pleasing God is the only thing that matters. And that's why Paul told the Romans, or the Ephesians, find out what pleases the Lord. Find it out. Search it out. Discover it. Because everything else comes after. Everything. Would you bow with me? Lord, your servant Peter sure has given us a lot to think about today and ponder as our servers come to share with us the meal of Jesus. And Father, I pray that as we take that bread and drink the cup, that it won't just be a methodical practice that we do mindlessly and without any introspection at all, but instead, Lord, in this moment, that we would ask ourselves, do I know? Have I found what pleases you? And having found it, is that what my life is about? Not was it, is it? And will it ever be? I ask for that. I plead for that in the name of Jesus.